Good afternoon and welcome to the Codependents Anonymous Stop Obsessing. And I am codependent. We will begin by saying the CODA opening prayer, which will be on the screen, but please remain on mute and follow along with me. There it is. In the spirit of love and truth, we ask our higher power to guide us as we share our experience, strength, and hope. We open our hearts to the light of wisdom, the warmth of love, and to the joy of acceptance. Codependents Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women whose common purpose is to develop healthy relationships. The only requirement for membership is a desire for healthy and fulfilling relationships. We gather together to support and share with each other in a journey of self-discovery, learning to love the self. Living the program allows each of us to become increasingly honest with ourselves about our personal histories and our own codependent behaviors. We rely upon the 12 steps and 12 traditions for knowledge and wisdom. These are the principles of our program and guides to developing honest and fulfilling relationships with ourselves and others. In CODA, we each learn to build a bridge to a higher power of our own understanding, and we allow others the same privilege. This renewal process is a gift of healing for us. By actively working the program of Codependents Anonymous, we can each realize a new joy, acceptance, and serenity in our lives. I have asked Nicole C. to read the welcome.
Nicole, you're on mute. You have to unmute.
Okay. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, now we can.
The welcome of Codependents Anonymous. We welcome you to Codependents Anonymous, a program of recovery from codependence, where each of us may share our experience, strength, and hope in our efforts to find freedom where there has been bondage, and peace where there has been turmoil, in our relationships with others and ourselves. Most of us have been searching for ways to overcome the dilemmas of the conflicts in our relationships and our childhoods. Many of us were raised in families where addictions existed. Some of us were not. In either case, we have found, in each of our lives, that codependence is a most deeply rooted compulsive behavior, and that it is born out of our sometimes moderately or sometimes extremely dysfunctional family and other systems. We have all experienced the painful trauma of the emptiness of our childhood and relationships throughout our lives. We attempted to use others, our mates, friends, and even our children as our sole source of identity, value, and well-being, and as a way of trying to restore within us the emotional losses from our childhoods. Our histories may include other powerful addictions, which at times we have used to cope with our codependence. We have all learned to survive life, but in CODA we are learning to live life. Through applying the 12 steps and principles found in CODA to our daily lives and relationships, both present and past, we can experience a new freedom from our self-defeating lifestyles. It is an individual growth process. Each of us is growing at our own pace and will continue to do so as we remain open to God's will for us on a daily basis. Our sharing is our way of identification and helps to free the emotional bonds of our past and the compulsive control of our present. No matter how traumatic your past or despairing your present may seem, there is hope for a new day in the program of Codependents Anonymous. No longer do you need to rely on others as a power greater than yourself. May you instead find here a new strength within to be that which God intended, precious and free.
Thanks, Nicole. CODA's 12 steps are the guiding spiritual principles of our individual recovery. I've asked Jocelyn to read them. You're on mute.
I am Jocelyn, recovering codependent.
Hi, Jocelyn.
Number one, we admitted we were powerless over others, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other codependents and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thanks, Jocelyn. CODA's 12 traditions are the guiding spiritual principles of our meetings. I've asked Tammy to read them.
I'm Tammy, grateful recovering codependent.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Tradition 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon CODA unity. 2, for our group purpose serves but one ultimate authority, a loving higher power as expressed to our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for membership in CODA is a desire for healthy and loving relationships. 4, each group should remain autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or CODA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to other codependents who still suffer. 6, a CODA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the CODA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. 7, every CODA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Codependents Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, CODA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, CODA has no opinion on outside issues, hence the CODA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thanks, Tammy.
Sarah, I'm going to read the etiquette again because we had about 15 people join us after I read it the first time.
Yes, thank you.
I'll make this real quick. I'm Jocelyn, recovering codependent. Here's a little bit of Zoom etiquette to share with everybody. Since this is our first Zoom workshop meeting, we're trying to be efficient. So please stick with us if we have some technical difficulties. So far, we've been doing pretty good. If you have any technical problems or questions, please write them down in chat and someone will answer you. To get to chat, hover your cursor at the bottom of your screen and click that chat button. If it doesn't work for you, you may call Leisha at area code 520-850-5677. If you move around or you're eating, please stop your personal video to avoid distraction. The host will mute everyone during the workshop to eliminate background noise. So if you're sharing, unmute yourself and say your name. And please be courteous as you do so. This workshop is being audio recorded, and it is still an anonymous meeting. So if you choose to share and respond to any questions from Heidi, please let us know and make us aware if you do not want your portion recorded. Heidi will give her phone number at the end for you to ask further questions if we run out of time. Thanks.
Thanks, Jocelyn. I would now like to introduce Heidi, who will lead our Stop Obsessing workshop.
I'm Heidi. I'm codependent.
Heidi.
Hi. Everybody wave.
I am grateful to be here. I just want to say thank you to the committee for asking me to speak and present this information. I've been in CODA for 11 years and I've been clean and sober for 20. So I've been doing the steps and recovery for a while. And it always helps me to talk about the solution and call the disease out, you know, and identify the things that, that have cost me a lot of joy and happiness and sanity. I did this obsession workshop for the Phoenix area about a year ago. So this is really just the second time that I've presented this material. It's been a really obsession and understanding obsession has become a real powerful part of my program. So I'm really excited to share that with everybody. First I want to introduce Teddy. Teddy is my co-presenter here. I take Teddy with me to workshops whenever I can because, it reminds me to take really good care of my inner child. You know, my little girl always needs my time and attention. I always need to be conscious of her, how she feels, what she's going through, you know, all of this recovery is so that I can take better care of her and keep her front and center. And so Teddy helps me remember to do that. So Teddy can just sit right there. What I have come to in my recovery is understanding that all the defects of character that I have, and there are plenty of them, we go over them and over them in our step work, which is just so healing and beneficial. But there's this crazy common denominator that is obsession. If you take away obsession, your defects of character lose their power. You know, it's like, how do you have a resentment without obsession? You know, how do you build a case against somebody and villainize them without obsession? You know, how do you victimize, you know, and get into victim thinking without obsession? Like, obsession is required for pretty much any of those fixes, you know, to work. And, so which one is really worse, you know, my resentment or my obsession that is what allows my resentment to build and grow and get more powerful and for me to lose myself in it and feel safe in it and take care of myself in a not very healthy way with the resentment, you know? Without obsession, I really can't do it, you know? So it's like obsession is what gives my defects of character teeth. And if I take away the obsession, all my defects of character lose their power, you know? And that puts me in a better place to be able to surrender them to a higher power and ask for them to be removed as I'm working through the steps and as I'm walking through my life. You know, learning how to stop obsessing, you know, we know better. We learn better. You know, we learn better through working the steps and hearing people in meetings. You know, we learn better. We just don't know how to stop. So that's what we're going to talk about is how do I stop resentment? Well, you stop obsessing. You know, how do I stop villain? You know, how do I stop judging others? You stop obsessing. You know, then how do I stop obsessing? Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. And the first step to stopping obsessing is just like our program teaches us in the steps, which is I admit that I'm powerless over it and that it makes my life unmanageable. Most of my life, I thought obsession was the answer, not the problem. You know, I have convinced myself over and over and over for many years that I just have to figure it out. And if I can just figure it out, then I'll be okay. You know, I'll know the right answer. I'll know the right way to respond to this person. I'll know what to do to control them or get even or find my power or, you know, or even spiritual stuff. Like, I'll, you know, if I figure it out, I'll be able to let it go. Well, you could just let it go. You know, getting into obsession is the opposite of letting it go. But in my codependent thinking, I have to figure it out first and then I can let it go. You know, I have to get all my ducks in a row and I have to comprehend all the pieces of it and understand and master it somehow. And, you know, thank God I've built some surrender muscle through my recovery and through lots of pain, you know, pain is a great teacher, you know, that where finally I can put things down without having to beat my head against a brick wall forever, you know. And it takes time, but I first had to come to the understanding that obsession was hurting me and that it was doing damage to me, to my inner child, to my life, to my relationships, and to my relationships with not just people, my relationships with everything, things that I love, things that hurt me, my relationship with my feelings, my relationship with my day, you know, my relationship with my goals and dreams, you know, like obsession really has nothing to offer in any part of my life. It really just doesn't, you know? And so that's what we're going to explore today. You know, I want to say also that I'm just a codependent. I'm not a therapist. You know, I'm not a counselor. I'm a codependent and I've been working the steps for a while, but this is all just my experience, strength and hope and my dedication to work in the steps and integrating the spiritual principles of the steps into my life. One of the greatest things I've done is just to continue to pursue a loving relationship with myself and my higher power through work in the steps. If you haven't started that process, do yourself a favor and find a sponsor or find someone to co-sponsor with and really start to dig in, because I know me and I love me and I care about me, and all of this work that I've done comes from that place. It wasn't that way in the beginning of my recovery. I was working the steps to fix me because I was a mess and I was a train wreck and I was broken. And, you know, over time in working the steps and learning how to love and care for myself and how to let that go and how to get out from under all that shame that I was carrying, you know, that was fun. You know, I have learned how to come from a place where my recovery is, I pursue it with passionate love for myself, not that, you know, fantasy, fix me, someday I will arrive and be all better and I won't have any problems anymore. You know, and like, God love me. You know, that comes from a little girl's desire to just be okay, you know, you know, I'm a fantasy addict. So, I made up stories that motivated me to take a look at myself. But also kept me trapped in a cycle of like, I will be okay until, you know, and today I'm okay because I'm okay right now. And I have to be in that, the truth of that and the belief in that, and surrender right now to my higher power and surrender to my life right now. And that I'm okay when I say I'm okay. And I'm okay even though I'm working on myself. And I'm okay even though things aren't perfect in my life. And there's not this someday I'll wake up out there and I'll have all the answers. That just keeps me in obsession, you know. That just keeps me in self-abandonment. That just keeps me in making other things and situations my higher power, you know. Today my life is enough. I am enough. The world is enough. My higher power gives me enough. And that's my truth. And when I stray from it, I gently ease myself back into that truth, you know, because that's what I've learned how to do to self-parent myself. So let's get started on the handout. And I hope that everybody has a copy of it, but I'm going to just be reading through it. So if you don't have a copy, you'll still get some picture of it. And I'm sure that we can get you a copy, either during the meeting or afterwards, you can get a copy emailed to you. It starts with, what is obsession? It is a compulsive, addictive thinking patterns that in a form of fantasy addiction that is triggered to medicate the buried toxic shame that drives our codependence. That's a lot. That is saying a whole lot. You know, obsession is not a, it's not a real point of pride. You know, that nobody wants to be told, you know, you're really obsessing about this. You know, it feels like a big slam. But taking the shame out of it, you know, it is really important to identify the difference between healthy thinking and obsessive thinking. And, you know, for me, it is addiction, and I had to treat it like addiction in order to arrest it. And so that's, you know, that's where I come from. I come from a world of arresting addiction. And so that's what most of my solution has been. And so that's what I'm going to share in the workshop today. The dictionary's definition is preoccupation or an idea or feeling that completely occupies the mind, uncontrollable persistence of an idea sometimes associated with psychiatric disorder. And I can say that I definitely have had insanity around obsession, very much like our second step talks about. So I'm going to talk about what obsession looks like. What does obsession look like? And what I want you guys to do, because this is your workshop, is to identify the pieces of this that you can relate to as we're going through it, you know, either just in your head or write it down or check mark it or highlight it or whatever, because this is the benefit that you get out of looking at these pieces and identifying with others too. I wish we were in a room studying where we could raise our hands. How many of you identify with that? And you can look around the room and and you can look around the room and identify, you know, okay, I'm not alone. You know, that's the gift we get in CODA, is that I'm not alone. I didn't make this up. I'm not the first human being that invented this. This is pretty consistent. And, you know, those of us with deep woundedness use these a lot harder than other people, maybe in the normal world, you know, if there's a such thing. But even normies do this stuff. So digging in your head, desperately trying to figure it out, worrying about something that might happen in the future and all the possible scenarios. I mean, that became a hobby for me, you know. I didn't have downtime in my head. There was no such thing. there was always something to obsess about. And thinking about the future was one of my favorite using strategies. You know, playing it out, all the different possibilities, and, you know, including in that often a fantasy story of my being able to control it. And then, you know, it would change on me so that then I was a victim to the worst case scenarios. You know, that's the problem with fantasy addiction, is that it takes a life of its own. So I might be able to start that process to medicate with thinking about things that are positive, you know, oh, well, this could happen and that could happen and it could go this way and it could go that way, you know, and making up the stories that medicate my feeling like, oh, I could, you know, I could end up rich, or I could end up with a great relationship, or I could end up, you know, getting a raise, or what, you know, whatever the positives are. But fantasy addiction, will, and obsession will get you there. It will flip on you at some point. And you become powerless about the excessive, fearful thoughts that come on. So instead of it being like how great things are going to be, then it can shift into how tragic things are going to be, how awful things are going to be. Nothing's going to go right. Everyone's going to leave me. You know, it's all going to just go to hell in a handbasket. I'll never be able to figure this out. You know, and the pain and powerlessness of that dead end. You know, if I'm looking to fantasy addiction to try to feel a sense of safety, and using obsession to do it, you know, trying to feel a sense of safety or being in control or having some, you know, having some, authority in my life, you know, and using it to fix my powerlessness over something, or using it to fix my pain around something, using it to avoid something, it's always going to backfire and end up beating me up, you know, and, That's been my relationship with obsession and fantasy addiction. So, going to the next one, idealizing or romanticizing about something or someone that you want. This is a way that, you know, I'm a love addict as well. So this is a way that, like, for instance, I can take, you know, a man that I'm interested in or that I'm starting to date, and I can give him, I can assign him like the most amazing qualities, you know, and pick and choose the parts of him that I see or a hint or something, and then make it into everything, you know, and then go over it and go over it until it becomes like a real fundamental belief of who he is and how amazing he is and how good this feels and how good for me this will be and how, you know, this will be so different from every other relationship I've been in. And, you know, all that takes obsession. It's all obsession, you know. I'm not practicing being right-sized with it. I don't, you know, I'm not going to have that thought that says, well, I really don't know him very well. You know, it'd be good for me to take some time to get to know him. More will be revealed. You know, how about I keep my, you know, my program strong while I'm in the process of getting to know someone. But instead, I'm going to fantasy glorify him as the be-all, end-all solution to my problems and how great I will feel when we're together and, you know, he won't cheat. He won't be that guy that cheats on me, or he won't be that guy that ignores me, or he won't be that guy that, you know, that drifts away, or, you know, whatever the story is. And all of that is about obsession, and idealizing or romanticizing. I can do the same thing about that job I want, or I can do the same thing about that vacation going on, you know. I mean, I can idealize and fantasize about anything. So the next one is trying to find the perfect thought that will make sense of everything and fix everything and tell you what to do, you know. And again, that one for me comes from a little girl that feels like there's this perfect answer out there. And if I can just dig hard enough and figure that out, then, like, somehow that will just make life all turn around, you know. Fixating on a person to figure them out. You know, I've done that with partners. I've done it with bosses. I've done it with parents. I've done it with sisters. I've done it with friends. I've done it with, you know, pretty much anyone. And all of that is about avoiding feelings and avoiding my feelings of powerlessness over people, or fear of they won't like me, or fear of their judgment, fear that they'll leave, fear they'll ask something from me that I'm uncomfortable with. And so somehow there's this fantasy story in my head that, if I figure them out, I'm safe. Figure out what they're thinking or what they're doing or what they want from me, or, you know, then I'll have like all my maneuvers all figured out and I can, you know, manipulate basically. So making up stories about what someone will think, say, feel, or do, again, that's future projecting for me. You know, playing out a scenario, like, what is it going to be like if I tell this person I'm angry, you know? Oh, well, they're going to react like this. They're going to do this. They're going to say that. They're going to, you know, whatever. And so I've put myself through that whole, you know, like all the crazy scenarios. I've put my emotional self, you know, and my poor little girl through all these scenarios using imagination and just terrified the shit out of her often, you know, of what all these worst case scenarios of, you know, how, you know. And I'm way out of my boundaries. I have no right to be pretending I have the insight to understand what someone is going to think, say, feel, or do when I, you know, that is very shameless to think that I can think my way into the crystal ball of what someone's going to do or say or think, you know. And there's a healthy level of, you know, preparing myself, to do what I need to do to take care of me. And obsession is, you know, on the far end of that. It's the far extreme of that, you know. It's not having healthy boundaries. It's not having healthy thinking boundaries. Replaying over and over what someone did to you and building up resentment or victimization. Favorite part of using, and And generally, in this list, it's the one that took me to my knees. You know, that is the one that backfires and becomes a very, very painful shame spiral for me. I did that for years with my ex-husband. You know, he cheated on me in the marriage, and, you know, I spent years trying to let go of my resentment and picking up obsession again and just rehashing and villainizing him and going over the details and the details. You know, he beat me up, and he didn't beat me up. He took care of himself in a way that caused me a lot of harm and pain for years. And then I did it to myself for the next three after he was out of my life. Like, I'm responsible for the 3 years I did it to me when he wasn't around anymore, you know, to continue to beat myself up. And, you know, that did a lot of harm to me and didn't allow me to let go, didn't allow me to get the life lessons out of that, didn't allow me to feel safe in the world, and reclaim my self-esteem from those events, you know. Ignoring something important and daydreaming about unimportant or mundane things in our life. That's classic avoidance for me. When I don't like something that's going on and it causes me to feel overwhelmed, then I got to go pick something that feels way more comfortable to obsess about and drive that shit out. I'm going to drive out that topic, you know, whatever, that trigger, or that, you know, part of my life that requires some attention, some care, some healthy boundaries, maybe some processing. But instead I'm going to be over here and I'm going to convince myself that what I really need to figure out is how I want to decorate my living room. You know, that is really super important. And, you know, I mean, it's like life and death now, you know? And I'm really ignoring this big part of me. There's this big pain coming up, or there's this big area of triggers or something that I don't want to pay attention to. I'm going to go in and make something else, you know, really important. Overanalyzing your choices when trying to make a decision until you're beating a dead horse. And this kind of goes with the last one too, which is flip-flopping with a choice for judgment until you drive yourself crazy. So for me, that looks like, you know, taking an idea and making it into, oh, okay, well, so let's see, if I do this, then all these good things are going to happen, and then that will be the result, and that will be the result, and I can see this going that way, and this going that way, and I really like all that, you know, and then, you know, and I settle on something. Let's say I settle on something or come close to settling, like, okay, well, this feels like the next right thing to do. Okay, I'm good with that. I've been praying about it. I've been turning it over. And then right before I actually take action and put that into motion and a plan and step into that, the truth of what my decision-making has brought me, I'm going to go, well, but then actually, and I'm going to go back to the other choice and I'm going to start glorifying that. But if I do this instead, then and build this big case about doing the other thing, you know, until I beat a dead horse and I'm in the same position where, like, okay, now I've convinced myself, you know, that this is the right thing to do. And, you know, and the obsession for me can take on, I call it, backing into the equation. I'm an accountant by trade. And, you know, so I do accounting and bookkeeping and I manage a general ledger, and, you know, everything has to balance to the penny. And there's this, you know, creative accounting where if you want your end number to be this, then you're going to start here and you're going to back into the equation. Like, oh, well, if I want my profit and loss statement to say this, then I need to come up with all these expenses to justify that number, you know? Which is manipulating the books, you know, but that's what I do in my head when I want to come up with this number. You know, if I want to come up with this result. So let's say I'm in love addiction recovery, and the decision that I made was not to contact this person. And I came to that result through a lot of surrender and prayer and talking to my higher power and talking to my sponsor. And so now I'm taking a time out from that person, and I don't contact them no matter what. Well, if the end result that I want is this some big aha that gives me an excuse to call him, then I'm going to start over here and I'm going to make shit up until I get to this place where now I have absolutely provided justification and rationalization to dial and pick up, essentially, you know, in addiction, you know, to pick up. And obsession is the way that I'll do that. That's the vehicle that gets me there, is obsession. But it's like one-sided thinking. You know, so I'm out there in my head and I'm looking for the evidence that supports this end result, you know. And I don't know if anyone else is that creative in their head. I'm sure I didn't invent it. You know, so getting there, that is a very dangerous way to think for me. And, you know, really gets me in trouble and gets me into a lot of self-abandonment. You know, my higher power lives in the truth. You know, my best self-care resides in reality. I've built a relationship with reality in my program. I'm super grateful for reality. but it used to be that fantasy thinking was my best friend and my only way out of my feelings. You know, today I take care of my feelings and I don't avoid reality. So, another way that we can use obsession is, criticizing yourself with stories of what you should have done, you know, and that's kind of like going back in time and making a future fantasy from back in time. So I'm already a fantasy that I have the right or the ability to somehow change the future. And all I'm doing is going back there to beat myself up. That's all I'm really doing, is just to, you know, is to go back there to beat myself up. And, but it does help me escape feelings. I'm raging at myself. Rage feels more powerful to me than the powerlessness of my feelings, my situation, the truth about something or someone. And so I'd rather go find a way to build a case and rage, even if it's against me, than I would to just sit in my powerlessness and the feelings around it, you know? And that's not so true anymore. I would rather sit in my feelings and the truth around it and honor my feelings and not go pick up fantasy and obsession, because I've done my first step. And I know it doesn't lead me to healthy answers and healthy changes. So that is page one. And I wrote a little key on the bottom, which is that, you know, what does obsession look like? It starts out like ordinary thinking, but intensifies and builds into mental self-assault, creating anxiety, panic, fear, rage, desperation, and or shame. So I might use it to get high for a minute. You know, to get high with my one up that I can create an obsession. I might get high with martyrism that I can create, you know, victimization that I can create a story about, you know, a fantasy of, you know, perfection or life or solutions or ease or whatever fantasy that I can create. But it's always I'm going to keep on going with it until I dig myself a hole and I overuse and I run out of dopamine, serotonin, because that's what addiction does. And then I'm going to start coming down, and then I'm going to try to use harder to get back up there. And eventually I'm going to deplete my serotonin and dopamine until I'm in this, what I'm talking about here, which is the mental self-assault. Then, you know, for me, I'll go into fear addiction, obsessing about fear, obsessing about rage, obsessing about, how blaming someone is a great way to obsess, you know, everything they did wrong, like that's going to ever get me anywhere, you know, really never fixed it, but it helped me escape my feelings. You know, codependency for me is about escaping my feelings. So I'm going to go to the next page. Let's see. Where are we time? 11. Okay. All right. So why do we obsess? And I talked a little bit about this. But it manages and controls feelings. For me, you may have other motives too, but it's intense. You probably get a feel for that. Can you imagine what it's like to be in my head, you know? Focused, detailed, obsessive thinking drives out feelings or creates new feelings to grow stronger and drive out the ones we don't want. So some examples for me are focusing on fearful thoughts can drive out loneliness. I didn't even know I was lonely for years. I had no idea what lonely even felt like. Who would be lonely with all that's going on in your head? It's super busy in there. Focusing on angry thoughts can drive out powerlessness. And that was a big fix for me. I hated that feeling of there's nothing I can do. You know, like, no, there's something I can do. I just have to figure it out, you know. And so I would take that angry rage that felt so much more familiar and powerful than that helpless feeling and just start digging and analyzing and going over it and making shit up and trying to see, you know, it's like taking all the puzzles in my closet, which there's probably like 10 of them, dumping them all out in the middle of the living room floor, scooting them all together, and then trying to put a puzzle together, you know? And there's no room for feelings in there, you know? Like, I'm busy. I'm super busy. So, and as insane as that sounds, you know, that is sort of what I would do in my head. Focusing on fantasy thoughts can drive out guilt or shame. So, you know, for me, that's about making up stories about me, making up stories about people, you know, all again to back into the equation. I want to arrive at a feeling that's better than what I feel right now. I want to arrive at a feeling. And, so I can create fantasy thoughts about, how great my life is going to be when I lose 10 pounds. That's one of my favorite fantasies. I don't know. I just always had this fantasy that if I lost 10 pounds, it would fix everything. You know, it would fix all my relationships. Everyone would like me. No one would ever leave me. No one would ever judge me, you know, like just power of that 10 pounds, you know, and it had nothing to do with reality. That is just a fantasy that, you know, I created. I'm the one that assigned that value of that 10 pounds, you know, and made up that story. But I could go back in that story as it was very deeply, you know, deeply penetrated into my brain and rehash that story that I had been telling myself since I was like 10 years old, and get immediate relief from whatever it was going on in my head. I could go into a new diet story and medicate. And in the meantime, you know, I'm actually neglecting my diet. I'm neglecting not only my feelings, but I'm neglecting healthy food nurture, healthy balance. I'm neglecting, you know, staying right sized with my food portions, all about control and medicating feelings that have nothing to do with, nutrition. the last thing that I'm doing is managing nutrition. But I think I am, and I convinced myself that I am. So focusing on self-criticism, can drive out pain. This was shocking to me to discover in my study. I did discover that beating myself up is like cutting. I was like, oh, okay. Now that makes more sense why I would be doing that. Because the pain of that blocks pain of what you did that hurt, you know, or what somebody else did to me or condition, you know, but if I can self-criticize and cause that kind of pain, it distracts me from other pain that feels more anxious or more, I feel more powerless for it, or it's much more, fragile or sensitive. So yuck, ouch, right? Poor me. I love me. Okay. So, why do we obsess? It provides us with temporary relief, a distraction or hope. It's just a way to manage ourselves until we learn how to take care of ourselves. Offers connection with others when we are together, like using buddies. It gives it more power, gives it more oomph. If you get other people to sign in or buy into it, that's why it's, you know, that's why people want to pull us into their story sometimes, or we want to pull other people into our story of, you know, all drama, how I was victimized, how this person is a tyrant, how this person, you know, is a villain. You know, how I've done so much for so many and they're so ungrateful and, you know, I mean, that's just kind of some of the stuff that we use. But when we're saying it out loud and getting other people to nod their heads in agreement, it gives that energy more power. We get higher off of it. It has more emotional, oomph in our own system. You know, it gets me out of my feelings even harder. It's a harder one up. You know, will bite me later, but right now I'm looking for something to fix how I feel. It creates conversation in your head to avoid feeling alone. You know, like I said, like the loneliness, you know, like, wow, this loneliness is like this crazy weird thing that I never even understood. And very, very painful when I came to understand. I think I had probably, I would say 5 years in CODA before I felt what loneliness felt like. And, I was busy, you know, and, you know, and what it did was it took me back to a very little girl within me that had built all the strategies to stay out of her loneliness, you know, and, you know, and I had to go through a lot of healing to get to that little girl and teach her that she was never alone. Because I'm here for her now, and that she has somebody in her life who will always listen and always be there and who loves her no matter what. And, you know, that I'll do my best parent for her that I can be. But I can't get to her to help her heal until I stop obsessing, you know, until this quiets down, you know, enough to hear her sobs. You know, her tears and connect with her ears. You know, she, my teenager's not quiet, but my little girl is quiet, and she learned how to stay out of trouble and stay in the corner and don't think about things and smile a lot, you know? So it's been a journey to find out what really is going on for her. So why do we obsess? To create an illusion of some power or choice in a powerless situation. To avoid fear of commitment by alternating the different choice scenarios, you know. So if I'm afraid of making the bad choice, making the wrong decision, and I have a lot of fear of shame around that, like everything I decide and everything, you know, that I, you know, all the choices I make all end up in crap, you know, and I'm just having that overwhelming fear that I'm going to make the wrong choice. Obsession is how I can stay out of it. You know, obsession can go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But if I this, well, but if I that, but then if I this, but then that. And I'm avoiding that, like committing to something and taking action and moving forward and then the paralyzing fear that I made the wrong choice, you know. And, you know, in CODA, I can reassure myself that yes, that paralyzing fear may happen once I make that commitment and move forward. But I have tools in CODA so that I can walk through that fear and retain my commitment and reevaluate, you know, when something has significantly changed, not just because I want to change my feelings. And that's a powerful tool of self-parenting. So seeking the thought, fantasy, story, scenario, answer, to create a good feeling to medicate bad feelings. Obviously, that's a good one. Family role modeling. So why do we obsess? Take a look at how your parents handled decisions, disappointment, or being hurt, or having disagreements, and where was obsession role modeled in your childhood, you know? And, you know, a lot of us had parents that didn't process out loud. They didn't know what was going on in their heads. And then other ones filled everything out on the table, and we were subject to all the insanity that was going on in their heads, you know? And, you know, my parents were more like the latter, like they processed out loud. And so, you know, I was like literally taught how to obsess, literally, you know? Thinking is like a place to go away to. It seems safer than being, you know, being in our bodies, or feeling. And, you know, I resonate with that so much, that thinking is like its own universe that I escape to. And, you know, I would look forward to driving somewhere, or being in the car, or being left alone, so that I can have obsessive conversations where I can get high and manage and fix my feelings. Not knowing I'm also creating damage and doing harm when I'm in there, you know, but I would look forward to it like I was going to the dope man's house, like I was going to a cop, or I was going to the bar, you know, or I was going to the boyfriend's house to get a fix, you know, and, you know, that time in my head where I can figure things out and make sense of everything, or find that gem, whatever that, you know, whatever that thing is that's out there that's going to make it all go away. As children in dysfunctional homes, our choices are limited, and thinking was one thing we could control to get relief. I had privacy around that. I go in my head and I can do whatever I do, and nobody can see on the outside. And, you know, and that was a safe place for me to go to manage my feelings and manage my thinking. Obsession from my childhood very much came from that's where my codependence was built. You know, having, like, for instance, you know, a raging dad, you know, and, you know, I obsessed and obsessed and obsessed about how to, control his rage. You know, how do I be the perfect daughter? How do I keep my room clean? How do I not have to walk through the living room where he is? How do I go to the bathroom without having to walk through the living room, you know, where he is, and where he's going to belt out something across the room and, you know, some kind of explosion is going to happen from him, or he's going to find a chore for me to do, or he's going to be mad at me for what I'm wearing or whatever. And I would just obsess and obsess and obsess about how to navigate around this, you know, uncontrollably angry person. And how to do it perfect. I would obsess about how mean he was, and then I would obsess about the bad girl I am, you know? I would obsess about how, like, for instance, if we did everything right, I would obsess about what a good dad he would be. And I would project all these wonderful, you know, fatherly qualities on him, and how great our family will feel, and how much fun we'll have when we're all together, and how great that will be. And obsess about, you know, making up that story ahead. And then I would obsess about if I don't do this right, or if I don't do that right, or when dad finds out that we broke the vase in the living room or whatever, how horrible that's going to be, you know? And, you know, so obsession started very young, and a place of trying to find power in a very powerless situation with an abusive parent who I had to find a way to live with, and I had to find to respect him or love him or fear him or obey him. It was an impossible scenario, and obsession was absolutely my first to about how to accomplish that. So, you know, it was built in my brain from a very young age. And then the last one on the why do we obsess is the critical demanding voice of obsession may feel like home and offer comfort even though it's doing harm. And, you know, again, that was like, you know, when I found that out about myself, that there is this somehow it's appealing. Like after I, you know, go into an obsessive story of self-criticism, and, you know, create a shame spiral and land at the end of the shame spiral, that there's this sense of home. There's a sense of relief or something. There's like some kind of crazy sense of, okay, well, that happened. And, you know, I didn't feel so lost. I didn't feel so alone. I beat up. You know, I felt ashamed. I felt like shit. But I didn't feel like I was all alone in the world trying to figure it out. And so that's what it was like that for me, that self-criticism, that beating myself up was very familiar. And then I could start the fantasy again about the hope of changing me and being a good daughter. You know, which, you know, at my 30s, what didn't look like that, or my 40s didn't look like that. It looked more like, well, here's how I'll, you know, have healthy relationships and keep the laundry up and, you know, get some healthy fitness in my life, or, you know, but it was coming from that same place, that little girl that just wanted to be, just wanted to do it right and be enough, you know? And so there was a sense of home with that. So, and the key to that section that I wrote down was that obsession is not actually making our lives better or different, although we think that's what we're doing. It only makes our feelings better or different. In truth, obsession is a drug. And when we use it, we're avoiding and neglecting our lives, our feelings, and ourselves. And that is consistently true for me. And my bottom, you know, my bottom with that addiction is to say it really does harm. It really doesn't get me anywhere. It really just distracts me from what I need to be doing, which is taking good care of me. Obsession, not care, although it's the best way I knew how to take care of myself for a long time. So what does it cost us? It usually ends in a shame spiral for me, overreacting, frozen, resentful, feeling very alone, beat up, or hopeless. Because it's addiction, I don't have boundaries with it, so I don't know when to stop. So it's not like I just make up the happy fantasy and then be like, okay, now I'm done. No, I'm an addict, you know? So I'm going to take it to the umpth degree. You know, I'm going to use it and use it and use it until it runs out of juice. And then I'm going to switch and, you know, switch to fear or switch to beating myself up or switch to something else. And the obsession is just going to take on a life of its own. It's like the alcoholic, which I am, but, you know, it's like the alcoholic that says, I'm good for two beers. I'm good. Two beers. I'm happy. I'm relaxed. I'm more whatever. And there's all the justification, but I don't stop at two beers. That's the problem, you know? So same is true with obsession. Is that I'm coming from a place of medicating. I'm coming from a place of fixing things instead of caring for them. So it's going to take on that addictive life cycle of its own. And I'm not going to, when I get, there is no such thing as enough in obsession. So I'm chasing the enoughness, but there is no moment when I go, okay, now I'm content, because it's addiction, you know? And right out of the gate, I was in self-abandonment. It's not coming from a place of care. It's coming from a place of, I have to fix this. That's the best way I can explain how it works for me. So like all addictions, it progresses. So we have to use harder just to feel normal. And this is so funny. Well, not really, but, so, you know, part of my bottom with obsession and recognizing my powerlessness over it was that I realized that I have to use in order to get out of bed in the morning. And what I mean by that was that before I even got out of bed, I had to obsess about my day, my plan for my day, you know, projecting all these things in it, creating my to-do list and all this perfectionism of what I was going to accomplish in that day. You know, like going through my head, just obsessively managing everything that could come up and all the things that are going to happen. And here's how I'm going to accomplish all these goals, and basically using obsession to get high even before I got out of bed in the morning, right? I might as well have been leaning over and doing a line on the bedstand, you know? I'm already got to make a big fantasy story about my day because I woke up feeling little, feeling fearful, you know, feeling overwhelmed, feeling a state of aloneness or abandonment, you know, feeling like, oh God, I woke up again. Happens every day. Damn it. You know, I woke up into this life that feels like just too much. And so immediately I would have to go into the story to fix that of how I'm going to be perfect today, how I'm going to control all these things. You know, here's the things that are coming up on my plate. I'm going to be the perfect mom. I'm going to be the perfect, employee. I'm going to be the perfect housewife. I'm going to be the perfect whatever, and just start immediately obsessing about all those little fantasy stories in order to just even get out of bed, you know, in order to just even face my day. And, you know, it wasn't until I learned how to start checking in with my little girl and started doing the inner child work in my recovery that I realized, you know, how scary it was to wake up every day and be here on planet Earth and feel like life is just this huge, overwhelming burden. And I feel completely out of control. And, you know, that was a hard reality to face because, I was in denial of that, you know, that those feelings were buried so deeply under there because I would go make up this perfect story of how competent I am and how accomplished I am and how in control I am, and, you know, and get high on that story of one up, you know, and that's all just one up energy. It's not authentic empowerment. It's all just one up energy for me when I was doing that. And abandoning one more time that little girl that's scared to just get up and go make breakfast and get ready for her day. And, you know, so when I started waking up and checking in with my little girl, instead of getting high on obsession, feelings started coming up, care started being developed, you know, my self-parent started to be born. And that was one of the best habits that I started to get into, was what happens when I wake up first thing in the morning. And, you know, today when I get up, I don't put my feet on the floor until I've checked in with my little girl and I've meditated, you know, and it's rare, but sometimes I'll have to get up when that doesn't happen. And make sure that I go back and do those things, because it's such a key part of my program to be grounded in my, responsibility to care for my little girl. And, you know, to be gentle with her and protect her from shame and protect her from an adult's problems and an adult life, you know, she doesn't need to be worried about the job or the virus or, you know, how to raise a daughter or, you know, or how to balance the books. Those are not her problems. You know, she needs to be told that she's beautiful and that, you know, today is a day for her to learn and play and be cared about. And I don't put all that burden on my 5-year-old anymore, or my 10-year-old or my 15-year-old, you know? And obviously check in with God, you know, surrender my day to my higher power, you know, find my higher self and ask my higher self to step in and take good care of me during the day and be my liaison with my higher power. So, really important every morning. The addiction tells us that the problem is out there when the biggest problem is now the addiction itself. Over time, the addiction becomes normalized and transparent to us, even though we're not getting much relief. You know, addiction, by the time I was done, it really wasn't doing anything for me but harm. And I still couldn't see it, and I still couldn't stop. We learn to catastrophize things so we have more material for our addiction and to justify why we do it. And it's, you know, a little embarrassing to say that this still happens for me sometimes. But it's right-sized embarrassment, I think. But my brain is trained to look for things that victimize me. And so it's almost like I get this little high, you know, when somebody makes a mistake or somebody hurts me, or somebody acts out or somebody, or shit goes wrong in my life, you know, wrong, you know, that's a sort of a shame-based judgment. But, you know, when things happen in my life that are less than ideal, yes. This virus is a really good example of like really good material for us to obsess about, villainize ourselves about, villainize others about, victimize ourselves about, you know, go on and on and on about what people are saying, thinking, doing, you know, and obsession is always about being feeling, you know, I told a little story right when we got on, but I'm going to tell again that, yesterday I went to the park with my daughter and our dogs, and long story short, there were some people that were not social distancing and, not to my standards anyway. And so, you know, I got a little snarky with them and, I definitely could have handled that better. And when I walked away and there were some angry words that were exchanged, I walked away and I was triggered and I knew that what I needed to do was put the trigger down because, trigger is my favorite time to obsess. And, you know, I had the desire to fix my feelings in my trigger by villainizing them, making up stories, getting super outraged, and to fix the powerlessness of my feelings. And instead I'm like, okay, I felt overwhelmed. People were close. I don't know what virus you have. I felt very powerless. I felt little. I felt victimized. I lost my voice to set boundaries. It was just a weird, awkward situation with dogs in a dog park and two gates and someone holding the gate for me. And, you know, I mean, it was just a weird, awkward situation and stuff. And it triggered me, and that's okay. And so I'm like, okay, I just need to walk away, just walk away. And that was how I set a boundary with the obsession, just walk away. And knowing that I have the right to circle back to it with myself and find closure. And I don't need to have the last word. I don't need to bark something else out across the grass. You know, I don't need to talk to my daughter about it and build a case against them. I just need to put it away, you know. And for me, that's that just, I'm just not going to use. I'm angry. I'm triggered. I'm setting it aside. I'm not going to go into obsession. And the energy was there because I was enraged, you know, and I was triggered. Thanks, Christian. I just got my 5-minute warning. So, I breathed. I looked at the grass, looked at the clouds. I looked at the skyline. I connected myself with my environment, you know, to just ground myself and get out of my trigger because I've got all that chemical going on in my head. I've got that adrenaline going on. I've got those messages floating around that these people are assholes, you know. And I'm like wanting to rip them a new one. How dare you put me and my daughter in danger, you know, and the story wants to just go on and on and on, you know. And so I was like, okay, calm down. And then, you know, a while later, I'm laying on the grass and I'm looking up at the sky and, you know, and I'm looking at the clouds and I'm talking to God and I'm getting right sized with myself and I'm having that conversation with me, which is, okay, I got triggered and breathing into that. I'm safe and I'm okay. And, you know, and it, I don't feel like it was okay how they handled it, but people have their own boundaries and they have their own understanding of the quarantine and they're entitled to that. Note to self, don't go to dog parks. It's a way to be trapped with people in an awkward situation where you, you know, where you're going to feel sort of cornered. Okay, so I won't do that again. All right. So, but I'm here now in this big grassy area and I'm safe and I'm okay and God's got my back. And I learned from that experience and I'm, you know, healthy shame. I'm not really proud of the way that I said 6 feet, dude. You know, that like I could have said that nicer. I could have said that in a different way. I could have said, I really want to respect the quarantine. So, can you just like step back from the gate? But I was triggered and angry. And so I just belted out this, you know, shaming remark. So I had some right sized healthy shame around that. And I walked through that process with myself, which I know that healthy shame will help me behave more appropriately the next time that that situation happens. And that's the gift of walking through that, you know, with myself. And then I sent them light and love, you know, and took back my shame that I was projecting that they did it wrong, that they're ignorant somehow, that they're in denial of this virus, that they're, you know, like we all have a different perspective about the virus and the risk factors for ourselves and what we need to do to have healthy boundaries. And every one of us has the right to have our own boundaries. I felt like my boundaries were trampled on and, you know, and I will be more careful to not put myself in that situation again. I don't want to feel powerless. And that's what I'm trying to fix. I don't want the powerlessness of knowing that, you know, that there's this crazy virus out there, but you know, there's trucks on the highway too that can swerve over in my lane. And I mean, you know, we could all die at any time. You know, I am not in charge, you know, all I can do is just stay between the lines as best I can and take care of me and that there's nothing to be gained by villainizing other people, you know? So that was how I got right sized with it. You know, in the past, my obsession would have taken me to a place where I would have had to talk about it and villainize these people to at least 5 or 6 different people for me to feel justified, for me to feel entitled, for me to feel one up, and all of that for what? To fix my feelings of fear and powerlessness. You know, and I could just skip all that shame spiral because I hate those and instead just, you know, care for and manage my feelings of powerlessness and fear around that there is this destructive virus in our lives right now and that not everybody is adhering to the quarantine and that's okay. It's okay. So I think I'm past my 5 minutes. I have one whole minute. Okay. So I'm going to just buzz through these really quick. As the addiction progresses, we often scare ourselves into a state of paralysis and can't do anything. I've scared myself into making this decision or this commitment or my opinion or what do I do? Into, you know, I've driven myself so crazy about it that I've made it life and death. You know, the decision is a life and death decision when it really isn't. It might just be, what do I do with my Saturday afternoon? You know, it might just be, you know, what's another good example of something that's simple? Time is a big one for me. I guess that's the one that's coming in. Is that, you know, like I get triggered with time. Like time is this, this sacred thing that I can never waste. And, you know, of course that goes back to some childhood messages and stuff that, still need some of my care and healing. And, so if I get this window of time, how I spend it somehow becomes this life and death decision, you know? And it really isn't. It really isn't. And so I have to get back into reality and out of obsession and out of the fear-based thinking about it and just say, you know what? I'm okay. I'm allowed to waste time. You know, I'm allowed to spend time how I want to. I'm allowed to be wrong, you know, instead of making it so black and white and so life and death. Often we forget how to feel and we intellectualize our feelings instead and create that toxicity and disease inside because I've got this lifetime of built up sadness or built up anger or built up whatever. And if I'm intellectualizing all the time instead of feeling and bringing that stuff through my system and releasing it and honoring it and caring for it and maturing my relationship with feelings, then it just becomes this powder keg ready to explode. And then I go into cycles of, you know, rage or emotional meltdown, because those feelings are gonna boil over at some point, you know? So I wanna learn how to not think that every feeling is something that I have to think. It just needs my care in my body. Okay, I'm going to go to the last one. So eventually we can feel trapped in a cycle of confusion and overwhelm as if our life is a puzzle we can never figure out. And that, you know, that thought is usually at the end of a shame spiral for me. And the, oh God, I did it again thing. So the key in this section is that obsession doesn't work. When has it ever helped you gain clarity or make decisions? Generally not something that works. So we're done with the first section and we're ready to start the steps. I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to our chairperson so that she can give us some direction on taking a short break and then we'll come back and work the steps. I wanted to let people know that the next page is we're going to walk through steps 1, 2, 3 rather quickly. But if you're comfortable and want to, you can spend the next 15 minutes kind of going over those and get started in that section.
Thanks, Heidi. Yes, we will now take a 15-minute break. So you can stretch or you can mute your video and audio if you want or chat amongst yourselves, I guess. So we'll see you back at 3:03. Thank you.
Okay. We'll go. Hold on one second. Okay, I'm Heidi, I'm codependent.
Hi, Heidi.
Hi. So we're gonna briefly work steps 1, 2, and 3 on obsession. And I'm gonna ask people to jump in and answer questions. And obviously we have a lot to do this page in about a half an hour. So I want people to be conscious of keeping their answers brief. But it's going to be real important that we all sort of do this together. So that's, we'll see how that works, but that's what I would really like to be able to do. I want to also remind people that this is being recorded. So to be conscious of, you know, whether or not you want your share to be as part of the recording. So the first question, or step one, we'll just go over step one. We admitted that we were powerless over obsession and that our lives had become unmanageable. And the first question is, what are at least 2 topics of obsession that you have engaged in? And I'd like to get a couple people to just say what those are. And it can be something that's either historical, or it can be something that's present in your life. The best way for you to do it would be just to unmute and just share those and then remute.
Finances, work relationships.
Okay. Thanks, Christian.
Santina, I'm codependent. Romanticizing love relationships and and what else? What have I done wrong? Something about the past, you know, like guilt obsession about the past. What if? Thank you.
I often have fantasies in my head about conversations that I'm having with people who aren't like around me. Okay. Because sometimes I want to talk to somebody, but I don't go and just do it. I start having a whole dialogue in my head, and I obsess about it's like a fantasy. It's really a problem.
Thanks, Chris.
Welcome.
I'm Catherine. I'm codependent. Two obsessions that right roll off the top of my head is controlling others and being a victim of others.
Okay. Me too.
I'm Brian, codependent. And being responsible for another's emotional state.
Thank you.
Hi. One of mine is overanalyzing or overthinking, overplanning.
Over. Thanks, Terry.
I'm Leisha. I'm codependent.
Hi, Leisha.
And I have found that I can obsess about people, places, and things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm Jocelyn. My biggest one probably is worrying about something that might happen in the future and all the possible scenarios, working those out so that I'm prepared in case one of them does actually come true.
Right. Gotcha. Okay, let's do one more.
Hi, my name's Marie and I'm codependent.
Hi, Marie. And
hi. I definitely villainizing others, especially in the workplace, is something that I find a lot of time to obsess about.
Gotcha. Thank you. So I'm going to go down to the third question because we kind of just did the first two. What are two ways that you have unsuccessfully tried to stop, control, justify, rationalize, or minimize your obsession? I'm going to share that one of the ways that I try to stop is by convincing myself that I don't care. So if I'm obsessing about a person that maybe hurt me or left me or slighted me somehow, that I'm going to put the don't care band-aid on. I don't care. I don't care what they did or I don't care how I don't care. It didn't matter to me. Didn't affect me. I'm just going to like put the don't care band-aid on that, and be needless. The other thing that I do to try to justify my obsession is I blame them. I blame them for obsession. You know, like the way they acted was so outrageous that it warrants obsessing about. Okay. All right. So let's have a couple other people that talk a little bit about how they've tried to stop, control, justify, rationalize, or minimize obsession.
I can't stop. When I start obsessing, it's an obsession. And I try to start praying, or like say some kind of mantra in my mind over and over again. And it's impossible to force yourself to stop. You need some kind of higher power, something to intervene.
Yeah.
I do, at least.
For sure. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
I'm Catherine. In terms of controlling others, I just do more. Like if others aren't helping, I'll do the whole project or thing. The payoff is accomplishments and praise and then a sense of being of use. And childhood, it goes back being rewarded by doing more than others. And the victim part, the blame, Looking at every detail of mistreatment, the payoff, feeling justified when pushing back, I get to judge without restraint, and it feels really familiar.
Mm. Right, that one-up is such a medicator. Yeah, me too. All right, someone else?
I'm Barbara. My obsession is my daughter and her drinking, and the way I, quote, control it is I don't read her Facebook goings on, and I stay away from her physically.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Terry. So the way I've unsuccessfully attempted to stop or control or justify whatever I'm obsessing about is I would try to do it harder. I know that sounds funny. I am just gonna overthink this so much that I am just gonna get to the end of whatever that illogical chain of thinking is, and then I will be done.
Yeah,
never works.
It's out there. It's out there. Thanks, Terry.
Constantina, codependent. I will unsuccessfully try to stop by forcing myself to stop, which doesn't work. And another way I do it is diversion. I find another obsession to obsess about.
Yeah. Yep. Switching drugs. Right. Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and go on to another question. What are some painful feelings that have been directly or indirectly caused by your obsession? And I want to combine that with the next question too, which is, do you believe obsession has caused you to harm yourself or others, and how? So just talk about the pain the pain and harm that your obsession has caused you, that you're aware of.
Anger.
Huh?
Anger.
Anger, okay. Building up.
Yeah.
Age, yeah.
The obsession, it just frustrates because I can't resolve it, so I get angrier. Right. And then, sometimes I'll blow up, usually in a healthy way. I don't want to hurt anybody, but I'll rage if I get too upset. The other day I was obsessing about a rude clerk at the grocery store, but really not a big deal, but I just got madder and madder and tried to like work it out in my head, like what I should have said, what he should have said, and have this whole dialogue going on. And I just ended up relaxing after a while. I called a friend and try to do something to not think about it.
Right. Anybody else on that?
I'm Janina. I'm codependent. And sometimes when I obsess over things, I use obsession not to focus on things that I want to be doing or things that have like sort of long-term goals. And the obsession is like related to maybe a short-term obsession that I have. And so when I indulge in the obsession, then I end up feeling sort of ashamed or like I didn't accomplish what I wanted to accomplish or I didn't use my time in the way that I had sort of intended to use it. And so then I use that then to beat myself up.
Right. Gotcha. Thank you.
I'm Terry. So what I would do is the painful feelings that would occur, what I would feel less than. So there was less than feelings. And then I would imagine some other person would be fine. And then what that would cause, the harm that would occurs, then I would self-medicate in some way that would not be helpful or healthy for myself or other people.
Right. Right. Well said, Terry. Thanks. Okay, I'm going to go on to another question. I'm going to do this one more question and then we're going to move on to step two. And I want you to think about this, and for me, this is, it changes and it depends on what the subject matter is, but how much time can you think about something before it's obsession and defining sobriety with a time boundary? And I have found that this is really an important part of arresting obsession because, you know, if I can't identify when I'm using and when I'm in healthy thinking, then I don't know what to turn over to my higher power. I don't know how powerless I am until I try to stop and set some boundaries around it, you know? So I'm going to, you know, basically what I have found for me is that it can be 0 to 15 minutes, pretty much, you know, unless I'm working steps on it and I'm in my adult and I'm talking to God about it, then I can think about something longer, you know, like, while I'm actually processing something and, you know, and in some healthy thinking with the boundaries of step work, or with my sponsor or something like that. But typically if I'm over 15 minutes, I know I'm using. You know, I mean, I know that like I'm beating a dead horse by then. And even if there's still thinking to be done around that, if I haven't made a decision, if I haven't come to a conclusion, if I haven't finished processing my feelings, by the time 15 minutes has happened, I probably need to set it down and grow myself up and come back at it with some fresh eyes from my adult, because if it's that big of an issue, if I probably am getting littler and littler and littler as I'm thinking about it, making it bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, cause that's what I do with my head. You know, it's just sort of the nature of thinking for me. So, but I'd like some other people, you know, when I say 0 to 15 minutes, like there are some things that I just say, I cannot afford to have that first thought, you know, and when I feel the thought starting to form, I don't go there. And it's a muscle that you can build over time. I absolutely couldn't for a long time do that. And I would be, you know, an hour into something or a week into something before I would finally try to set a boundary and like pull that in, rein that in. I'm just, you know, like I'm so mentally exhausted and, you know, like Chris said, enraged, or I've frustrated myself so much that I'm in tears, or I'm curled up in the fetal position and my life is a train wreck when, you know, it's not that big of a deal. I've made it so big with all that obsession over and over for a week or a day or 3 hours straight or whatever. And, you know, one of the other ways that I use that I have to really watch is just that there's this continuous background noise going on where every time I have a moment between activity in my life, I'm going back there somehow to, you know, stir that up a little bit, you know, whatever. Instead of leave it alone, you know, I'm at work now, you know, or I'm doing other activities or I'm spending time with my family or whatever that is. And then making a conscious choice to come back to it and tackle it with my full attention and boundaries and my higher power present, where I can actually make some headway in processing those feelings or making a decision or something like that. But it does a lot of damage when it's this background noise that's continuously going on that I keep losing my power to, you know? So I really watch out for that. So anyway, does anyone have any thoughts about how much time can you think about something before it's obsession to you? What would you say?
Hi, I'm Terry, I'm codependent. So for me, it's pretty much as soon as I realize, I say to myself, I don't need to think about that. I need to think of something else. And then I consciously shift my framework. And so as soon as I realize that as soon as I say that to myself, I realize I was obsessing. So I don't have an actual, you know, 0 to 15 minutes. I just know that was obsessing. Unless it was a problem I really needed to focus on, like, I don't know, some task that I'm, project that I'm working on, then I know, wow, I was really obsessing.
Right. Thanks, Terry.
Hi, I'm Chris. I know when I'm not living in the moment, when it's stealing the time away from what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little slow on the uptake. I might have something on my mind first thing in the morning and last thing at night, in the shower, while I'm driving, and then I realize I'm obsessing.
Totally. Yeah, I can't tell you how many thousands of times I have caught myself. You know, I've been thinking about this for a half hour again, and I shut it down half an hour ago, you know? Like, when did I pick it back up? I have no idea when that happened, but I don't remember thinking about anything else except this, you know? So, yeah, it's like, it's autopilot. It just goes and goes and goes, you know? So let's move on to step two and do a question there. So, do you believe that your higher power is capable of helping you arrest your obsession and why?
I'm John, codependent.
Hi, John.
For me, I don't have a really specifically defined higher power, but I feel like I'm connected in some way with a higher power when I am present in the moment, usually in nature or perhaps in some activity with people or animals that brings that present moment really, really to the forefront. And I think that would be the way to arrest obsession. So I absolutely believe that.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Catherine. Well, actually what I do in my life, it's like a path, you know, it's like a path that I start out on, and I can really go far down the path, or I can stop it. Like barely when I realize it's trying to fix other people, when I'm trying to control other outcomes, when I'm pushing my agenda, when I'm just doing all that and forcing it and, like, you know, just trying harder and harder, and I'm getting nowhere, that's when it dawns on me that, you know what, this isn't your path. You're on somebody else's path.
Right.
So I usually stop and reassess at that point, but sometimes it can go on for weeks. I mean, it can be a long process.
Thanks, Catherine. I'm going to ask another question. What have you expected obsession to fix, and how was that insane?
I'm Tammy. I expected it to fix the other person's thinking about me.
Yes. That's good. Yes. Totally.
I'm John. Expected it to fix problems that other obsessions caused.
Oh, wicked obsession. It's so wicked. Anyone else?
I'm Rebecca, and I expected to change the past.
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kathy, codependent.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, expected it to fix everything so that I didn't have to do step work around it. You know, if I can obsess about it, then I don't have to do all this work and heal all these feelings. I can just do it myself.
Yeah.
By obsessing.
Right. Awareness. Yeah.
Constantina, I expected to get justice out of it. Which is really,
justice.
Really, it's really, I know. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. If I can figure it out, I'll make life be fair. Yeah. Okay, and then let's go into step three. So it's kind of like this, the last question. So step three is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. How has it worked to turn your will and your life over to obsession? Is obsession caring?
No, but it feels like it sometimes.
For sure. I'm going to share a little bit about that. This is Heidi, codependent, and you know, obsession in feeling sorry for myself. Like, I came to understand that there was this rule in my childhood that was, that you can never feel sorry for yourself. You know, there, that was one of our family dysfunctional rules, you know, was to not feel sorry for yourself. And I'm sure it was tied to mom and dad's guilt and shame. So, you know, so there's this rule of like good people don't feel sorry for themselves, you know? So I would, you know, stuff it, you know, and then when it finally popped out, it was obsessive self-pity, you know, that I didn't have a chance to care about all the little events that were going on throughout the day, things that made me feel fearful or weaker or taken from or violated or afraid of or whatever. I'm not allowed to feel those things or think about those things. So they're just getting stuffed and stuffed and stuffed. And then when they finally pop out, it's at an obsessive level of poor me, you know, and the relief that comes with that kind of like obsessive victimization when you've been stuffing all the, your need for empathy, for self, you know, for self-compassion. You know, I needed those things. I needed somebody to teach me how to be compassionate with myself and how to have balance with like, ouch, that really hurt. I need to take care of myself around that. Like I need, you know, I'm allowed to have feelings around that and then release those feelings and then learn the lesson or move into the empowerment or step back from somebody or whatever it is that event, you know, warrants. But the stuff, and then obsess in self-pity or obsess into victimization, you know, that it's natural that I would have done that given that there was this rule in my home that, you know, don't feel sorry for yourself. And so, you know, I can see how that happened for me, that I did feel cared about with my obsession because that was often the only care I got, you know, that was the best care I could get. Another question, do you believe God can care for your will in life better than obsession can? And talk about that a little bit.
I'd like to add something. I'm Catherine, codependent. The thing about obsession is it kind of feels like higher power in a way because I'm being run by it. You know, it's kind of leading me. And if I have a good enough cause to be obsessing over, then I feel really good about me. You know, I really feel like I'm a good human and, you know, I'm doing the right thing and, you know, all these boosters that I get from obsessing, but I'm really obsessing and it's a waste of time and I'm taking time away from my life and to be with the people I care about and love. And I've almost used CODA as a way of escape too, because, you know, I can be in a meeting and I don't have to deal with other stuff. So I've used that both trying to connect with higher power. And sometimes I have to be quiet in order to hear higher power, because if I keep talking, I'm just not going to hear anything.
Right. Thanks, Catherine. Yeah, I think that's a really powerful point. And it's like obsession is how I literally take my will back. Like, what would demonstrate more than that, me taking my will back? So I, you know, I work my third step and I give my will and my life to God. I wouldn't be obsessing about it, you know? So obsession is really taking it back. And, you know, and I'm in a frenzy of obsession because it's not a problem I can fix. It's a higher power problem, you know, it's something that's out of my control and I need to be able to surrender that. And that's clearly why I did that in the beginning. But when I take it back and obsess with it, it's because I'm trying to play God, you know? So good point. Does anyone else want to share that? Do you believe God can care for your will in life better than obsession can?
Hi, I'm Terry, codependent. So yeah, I do. And what I've discovered, at least for me, is that it's like this dance, or it's like a dance. So I give it and I take it and I give it and I take it. And as long as I can just let go of being fearful of not being in control,
if I can let go of that. I mean, just even thinking about, oh my God, I'm not in control. Because that was a behavior that I needed as a child to feel safe and survive. Won't go into details. But, so if I can keep it as a dance and keep it joyful, then I'm a lot more successful at accepting that God is totally in charge of that.
Right. Thanks, Terry. Okay, and then the last question is, what does faith have to do with arresting your obsession? Does anyone want to share on that?
Hi, I'm John. Sorry.
Oh, thank you. That there is a higher power, a higher intelligence, a higher love, and a higher wisdom than mine. But I'm connected to it. And like someone else said, I can connect better when I'm quiet and stop the noise and static on my part.
Thanks, Tammy. John?
I find that when I start to try and get quiet, my obsessions get very noisy and things feel worse. And pushing through that period of everything getting worse and even more painful and even more chaotic involves a lot of faith and patience.
Right. Thank you. Okay, good job, you guys. We worked the steps on obsession. And I would encourage everybody to, maybe put some more time and thought into answering the questions and go over them with your sponsors or go over them with each other and, you know, get the benefit of really, really doing that 1, 2, 3 and surrendering this stuff, you know. But we're going to move on to recovery tools to arrest obsession on the next page. So we must first have boundaries about how, when, where, what, and why we think in order to know whether we are just thinking or obsessing, whether it's healthy or addictive thinking. And, you know, my addiction doesn't want to define that. My addiction wants a green light to just do whatever it wants. You know, it's on autopilot. It medicates. I've got justification for it. It wants to be able to just go away and do its thing. But in my recovery and after working my first 3 steps, I have to say, you know what? I can't let my mind just decide for me where it's going to go wander to and what it's going to do with my resources. And what it's going to draw and what it's going to create in my heart and in my, you know, and in my head. And so I have to be more conscious. And that means that I have to have boundaries. You know, I have to know what healthy thinking is and what addictive thinking is. Because it's not like we can just stop thinking, you know. It sucks kind of in the same way that being a food addict sucks. Like you can't just stop eating, damn it. You know, like I could stop drinking. Because I don't have to drink to survive. And I could stop doing meth because God knows I don't need meth to survive, right? But I have to think to get by. I have to think to decide, you know, to do my job. I have to think to be a parent. I have to think to be a human. You know, I can't just stop thinking. So it's a whole lot more slippery slope than, you know, some other addictions are. Catch the obsessive thought as soon as you see it and ask your higher power to remove it. That's that 0 to 15. That's the zero end, you know, is that when I set a boundary for myself that I just don't need to think about this anymore. I've exhausted it. I've clearly, I know where I stand. There's no stone unturned anymore. You know, I've gone over it. I've done steps on it. I've processed it. I've shared it. And the only thing there is just using behavior for me. There's no reason to go back, you know, unless something changes. And then I give myself permission to do it with some healthy boundaries. But other than that, you know, I need to put it down. And so that would be saying that, like, I just don't go there no matter what. And when I do, I give it to God. Like, God, please remove this obsession. Please remove the thoughts about so-and-so or this event. you know, and I turn that over to you, and, you know, and I know that you're going to help me remove it if I do my part. So surrender now wherever you are, and eventually you can intervene before you even start. So, you know, I used to feel like when I caught myself, I would have a shame spiral. You know, when I caught myself obsessing about something that I had set a boundary about, I'm not supposed to be thinking about that. And then I would catch myself and I would feel shame, you know, and I would feel ashamed that, oh, F, you know, here I am again doing this, you know. And what I eventually learned is that, you know, shame doesn't solve anything. You know, shaming myself about it doesn't do anything. So instead of I guess arrogantly deciding that I have control, I can surrender and admit my powerlessness and just surrender right now. It doesn't matter that I've been thinking about it for an hour or that I've been thinking about it for a week. It doesn't matter what I thought or how those have built me up into a frenzy, how those have built me up into a shame spiral, how those have whatever. Just surrender now and just let it go now, because my resistance to the obsession just keeps the obsession going, you know? So that's, you know, you just surrender now. And like wherever I am and whatever I'm doing, I don't have to justify it. I don't have to have a conversation about it. I can just stop right now. Just right now. Okay, there I am. There you go. Okay, so what do I need to get my mind on? What do I need to, you know, what do I need in order to make that, where's the bridge to the other, to another topic? So that my brain has something to chew on, because it's not going to just chew on air. It has to think about something. To grow yourself up, obsession is always your regressed child running your head. So that's true for me. You know, my teenager's usually the one that's angry and villainizing and building a case. It's usually that teenager self-righteousness energy for me. And it's very often my little girl that's creating scary stories, you know, in obsession. So I've got to take care of them. I've got to take responsibility. I've got to grow myself up, and I'm not going to be able to grow myself if I stay engaged with the trigger, which is the obsession. You know, I've got to get out of the trigger. I've got to get back into my healthy head, healthy thinking. My life is good. I am safe. I have a higher power who loves me. This event, situation, person does not define my life. Let some time pass, because, you know, I've worked all my brain chemistry up into this frenzy. So, you know, I've got to have a timeout for myself in order to get my chemistry balanced, in order to get my spirit activated, in order to get back into my loving self-parent. I have to grow myself up in order to arrest the obsession. So then confront the obsession's shame-based lies and do power work. So this might look like, if I've got all that energy going on, I might just need to say, you know, I take my power back and get mad at the shame, at the obsession, at the storyline that's going on. You know, I take my power back. I am safe. I am enough. And confront whatever that story is that's going on, you know, but that anger energy, that righteous anger, that healthy protecting anger, that back off an offender anger, you know, even if the offender is just my obsession and the shaming that's going on, you know, those are powerful, and it tells my body, you know, to step into my power and get out of that addiction, you know, digging at me. Identify your feelings behind the desire and care for them. So, you know, obsession, I'm trying to fix something. I'm trying to, you know, I'm needing something, you know, and underneath of all obsession is some healthy need that I have, some authentic need that's not being met. It's not being met probably not only because I'm obsessing instead of caring for it, but because I might have been neglecting it before I started obsessing, you know? And so what is that about? What's underneath of the obsession? What's under the addiction? Just like any addiction, there's something underneath driving it. And it always leads back to, how do I take care of myself better? What am I really needing under there? You know, am I needing reassurance? Am I needing a boundary? Am I needing to talk? Am I needing to cry? You know, am I needing purpose and meaning in my life? You know, so exploring that. So say the serenity prayer and put your object of obsession and the obsession in your God box. And that's one of my favorite things to do, is to put stuff in my God box. And then my thoughts, when I start to think about that thing and I have that boundary that says I no longer need to think about that thing, I have this memory of putting it, writing it down and putting it in my God box. That was my surrender to my higher power, and I can lean into my faith in that process and reassure myself that I'm safe even though I'm not thinking about it. I'm safe for not thinking about it, you know, and I'm leaving it in my higher power's hands. And that might not feel reassuring when you first start doing that, but over time, you know, that becomes our truth because we watch it work over and over. So if you're new and you haven't watched that work for yourself, then give yourself that experience for a while, and that will probably start working for you too. That, you know, that like, okay, I feel the reassurance. I used to put it in my God box because my sponsor told me to. Now I put it in my God box because it works, you know? And it reassures, you know, I feel that truth in my body, you know? Surrounding yourself with reminders. Sticky notes, phone banner, affirmations, setting your alarm on your phone to remind you to pray or turn it over. That can be really powerful when you have an ongoing obsession with something that you just can't put down. You know, like for me, that's love addiction. Like love addiction is one of my, you know, like obsession gives love addiction wings. So I have to surround myself with reminders to turn it over, let it go, focus on God, and those kinds of things. And so, like I said, phone banner, affirmations. Here's one on my wall right behind me. I don't know if you guys can see this. Surrender, surrender more. Yes. Redirecting. So filling your mind with other thoughts to break the obsessive thinking. So, you know, think about work, thinking about talking to friends, doing activities with others, watching TV, reading, audio, CDs, hobbies, sports. And, you know, what I found is that even if a choice is not the best self-care, you can get better balance later after you've arrested the obsession, you know? So even if it's not a really great idea for me to sit all Saturday and binge watch Friends, you know, if that's what I need to do to get over a relationship and not call him, I can get balance with Friends later. You know what I mean? I can stop binging on it later. There's other ways to take care of myself, but I'm not going to beat myself up about Friends or a gallon of ice cream, you know, when I'm going through something really heavy duty that I need to arrest. So, because it'd be really easy for me to, I don't want to watch Friends and I, you know, and the last thing I want to do is eat a gallon of ice cream. And so I'm white knuckling it. And then the next thing you know, I'm calling him, you know, and I've done that. So. Practice being instead of thinking with meditation, focused breathing, mantras like all is well. All is well. I am safe is one of my favorite ones. I am safe. Yes. And, you know, just that reassuring care that I'm here, I'm safe, I'm in my world, I'm in my life. No one can steal that from me. I don't let fear take over. And I'm allowed to just be. I can just be. directing your thoughts to focus on joyful self-care like vacations, hobbies, loving people, fun projects. And that can be like a gratitude list, like who in my life am I grateful for? You know, what are some of the blessings of my recovery today? You know, or how does my higher power show me that he loves me? You know, and, obsess about that. You'll be good. You know, be accountable by consulting with your sponsor about arresting this aspect of your codependence and set up a recovery plan with daily calls on your progress. It was important to me to treat it like addiction and not just treat it like some little defective character or whatever that like popped up, you know, like, no, this was big. This was big for me. And, you know, I was losing all my power in it and staying stuck in old, you know, shame-based behaviors. And, you know, obsession is the reason why. It just kept me circling and cycling and circling and cycling, even though I knew better. It just kept dragging me right back into the shame. Pray for the obsession to be lifted every morning and journal nightly with your inner child or God or both. Remind yourself that your HP has your highest good in mind, but your brain just has data. You know, it isn't magical. It doesn't know the future. It's not a crystal ball. You know, it doesn't know what people think, say, feel, or are going to do. You know, it's really limited in its abilities. And it's a great tool if I use it right sized, but if I'm assigning all the magical qualities to it and going to it for the answers all the time, then I'm not really getting anywhere, you know, and I'm closing off to the answers that my higher power has lots of different ways to bring those in into my life, into my heart, into my, you know, inspiration or insight or bring me a messenger. You know, there's lots of ways that God can get the answer to me. I don't have to just rely on my brain. You know, it's giving it too much power. Identify patterns of obsession, where, who, what, and when, so you know what to surrender and where you're vulnerable. So like going back to what I was talking about, using friends or using buddies, you know, like there are people that I obsessed with, and knowing that those are vulnerable people for me because we like to villainize together and it's like super fun and very bonding, you know, and in, you know, at some point in my recovery, I realized that that's kind of like the crux of most of my relationships, you know, like that's a really important piece that we gang up on somebody together or take inventories of people or talk about our problems with each other, not in an empowered way, but in a victim way. You know, how we can talk about what a mess the world is or how shitty men are to us or, you know, I mean, what, you know, whatever. And it's like, okay, there's healthier things to talk about. I can bond with my women friends without using in this way, without going into obsessive, villainizing, victimizing, and all that stuff, you know. And I know who has healthy boundaries around that stuff and who doesn't, you know. So what is my motive in that friendship or calling that person on this particular day, you know? And the other thing that I wanted to talk about with that one is that one of my favorite places to use is commuting. You know, in the car, all alone, nobody there, you know, and your mind can just like take off and you got, you know, half an hour or 45 minutes or whatever that you can just make up stories and go on tangents. And like, you get to work and you're like, you're not sure even how you got there because you weren't really there, you know? And, that was one of my favorite ways and places and times to use, you know? Once we turn it over, the feelings underneath that are driving the addiction are revealed. And this means it's time for deeper recovery and healing, another layer of the onion. So whatever it is that we've been masking, avoiding, stuffing, it's all going to come out when we stop obsessing. And that's going to, you know, inspire us to really love ourselves, to really look at our vulnerability. You know, it was like the discovery that I was lonely. You know, I mean, that was a part of me that I didn't even know existed, you know. That I was, you know, that I was lonely and all I really wanted was a family to just be at home with and happy, you know, and it was really a beautiful reunion to find that innocent part of me. So have fun with that. So I'm going to read this little section about self-parenting. And this is just my thoughts about it. But I think that this is the true gift in this piece of recovery. Obsession is a call for help from our inner child. Answering that call is how we build love for ourselves that is sustaining, fulfilling, and empowering. Self-intimacy develops as we arrest the obsession and gently face fears, explore thoughts, feel feelings, and trust God while letting life unfold within and around us in our own care. Self-parenting is learning to think kindly, caring, compassionately, and honestly. How would you want a friend to talk to you or a parent or your higher power? You know, an important question is, what does your higher power think about you? And why should you think any less? Explore the real motives behind your obsession. What is it fixing? Talk to little you. Ask about the overwhelming feelings and let him or her express all fear and anger, overwhelm, outrage, shame, injustice, confusion, and pain, and then care for them. Apply comfort to pain, apply courage to fear, apply understanding to confusion, apply love to shame, apply soothing to overwhelm, apply faith to hopelessness, apply togetherness to loneliness, apply freedom to suppression. Sometimes just be with them and listen. That's where that healthy bond with ourself comes from. That, you know, the way that I describe that often is to say that I feel like I'm at home within myself in a way that I've never found home anywhere, you know, except for getting high, you know. There's this home I get to carry around within me because I have that relationship with her. Identify any actions that you're neglecting, afraid of, frozen, or avoiding, and instead directing that energy into this internal hamster wheel process that feels safer because you control it. Grow yourself up with God's help, get right-sized with what is scaring you, and ask God for the courage to take action. All that obsession just keeps us from taking care of our lives. Building a better understanding of healthy decision-making. Gather information, sit with it, ask others, wait for what feels right, consult those you trust, have a backup plan, be open-minded, be teachable in the moment and unattached to expectations. Those are healthy tools that we don't generally use when we're in obsession. And as we change our values, we change our lives. And I want to talk a little bit, let me check on time. All right, we're okay. I want to talk a little bit about assigning value. And you know, in self-parenting, you know, I have come to understand that I am the one who is responsible for assigning value to things. As a child, my parents assigned value, my peers assigned value, you know, the value of the right genes, the value of being honest or not, you know, the value of what weight you are, you know, all those influences from all of society, all of parenting, all of childhood, traumatic experiences, all of that formulate what we value and what we put value on, you know. And especially the putting value on what you put value on. I put value on what you put value on. You get to determine what's valuable and what's not valuable. And then I have to manipulate you in order for you to think I'm valuable because you determine what's valuable, right? So it's my job to put value on things. I have to take my power back to have the right to assign value. And that doesn't just mean the value of me. It means the value of my life, my higher power, my priorities, my feelings, my history, you know, my life lessons, my purpose and meaning in life, my direction, but also all the things around us, you know, like the value of my home, you know, the value of my, my sacred space that I create, you know, the value of my teddy bear, you know, the value of the honor that I place in people or or the honor that I give to the spiritual principles. You know, all of that is mine. All of that is my power, you know, and the question is, am I using that power in a healthy way? You know, am I taking responsibility for where I place value, or am I still running around trying to fix what everybody else values because they somehow have the right to assign value? So I get to assign value. I get to assign that my body is valuable, that my feelings are valuable. I get to assign that, you know, how involved I need to be with politics, you know, is valuable. I get to assign those things. And, so, you know, a lot of that for me is around the fear of shame and recovery around the fear of shame. Shame is that feeling that tells me that I'm not living in healthy values, you know? But if I have some authority in what those values are, I'm not giving away the right to everybody else to shame me. So it's really interconnected, you know? So ask yourself what your values are, and that's the power of self-parenting, is that my self-parent gets to decide what is valuable and what isn't valuable, and what value things have for me, and my values protect me from shame. So, good topic for journaling. And so now we're going to move on to the last piece of the workshop. It's 3:57, this is a little tool that was, I feel like it was really God inspired for me. And I would like for all of us to do it together. I would like you all to think of something that you often obsess about, something that is important for you to spend some time thinking about, a decision that you need to make, or, an action that you need to decide how to move forward, or maybe an issue with a friend or a relationship, you know, where you need to decide what to do to take care of yourself, or if there's a boundary you need to set, you know, whatever comes to you that feels current in your life right now. And we're going to go through this steps of healthy thinking, so that you can kind of get a feel of maybe where to set some boundaries for yourself around thinking. Okay. So the first thing that we need to do when we're in a healthy thinking process is to set a time boundary for ourselves as, obsession addicts. Okay. First step, obsession addict, right? You know, I can't just go to the bar, you know, and think I'm not going to drink. So anytime that I'm engaging in some kind of decision making or thinking, I need to have my adult on board, and I need to have some boundaries around what I'm doing. You know, I'm not just going on a wild goose chase here, because I know where that leads. So, so is this the time for me to be thinking about this? You know, is an important question for me. And you know, am I using this just as a filler? You know, is this just a filler? Am I using this to avoid some kind of feeling? And so, you know, I want to come at this decision with a boundary already in place. So that's the T for healthy thinking, is time boundary. Then H stands for higher power. So that's where I'm going to pull in my higher power into my thinking process, so that I'm not alone, and I'm not in the, and that this process isn't being run by my addiction or my fear or my little kid, but rather that it's being managed by my higher power. So I'm going to just pray for God's will, support, and care to come to the right answer or understanding or conclusion or some clarity or whatever it is that I'm looking for when I'm thinking. So I is for inner child. So check in with your inner child to make sure you're in your parent. So I want you guys to take a second for yourself and, you know, whatever level of comfort you are, to go ahead and check in with your higher power and check in with your inner child and see how that feels to consult with them as you engage in this thinking process. You know, it's like we're a team and we're doing this together and we're not escaping or going out or somewhere. You know, we're not going to fantasy land, you know, and, you know, we're here grounded in our life and I've got my kids on board. I'm taking good care of them and they're not in charge of the thinking. My higher power is in charge of the thinking, you know, and we're going to do this together. And I feel supported in that process. So the N stands for neutral. So what I mean by that, open-minded, right-sized, and not in fantasy with a targeted outcome. That was kind of like I was talking about that accounting thing that I do, you know, that backing into the equation thing. You know, just checking it out, like being honest with myself and saying, like, do I have a target here? Am I looking to build a case against somebody, you know? Am I hungry to figure out how right I am so I can have a one-up? This isn't the time to be addressing this real decision. I need to be taking care of my defect that's coming up, not in this decision, you know, not in exploring what is it that I need to do about this important matter to me, you know? So I want you guys to do really quickly, just check in with yourself and see if you're in a neutral place. And maybe if you find that there's some alternate motives, maybe some healthy ones and some, you know, and some not so healthy ones, that this would be the time when you can ask your higher power to surrender those, you know, to turn those over and say, help me stay out of that. Even though that feels good and it feels like a fix and it's pulling me that direction, you know, help me stay right sized and help me stay in my healthy boundaries with this, and not hurt myself in the process. So K is for kindness, practicing moving thoughts and motives toward compassion and caring. And for me, that is just like the spiritual principles of, you know, acceptance, letting people be who they are, you know, giving people a break, understanding that people are human. A lot of times my obsessed thinking is about building cases about people, villainizing them, defending myself with, you know, whatever outrageous behaviors they have had. And so I just need to be kind. And that doesn't just mean towards others. It means towards myself. You know, I need to practice kindness towards myself instead of intolerance. In this process, I need to make sure that with my thinking that I'm not expecting perfection from me, that I'm not putting this overwhelming burden on myself, that I'm not painting myself into a corner that I'm not going to be able to get out of, you know, with whatever it is that I'm deciding to do. And then I is for inventory. So a searching and fearless exploring of the situation, feelings, and opportunities. And this is where I'm going to give you guys a couple minutes to do this inventory for yourself. And that's where you're going to take a look at what is it that I'm trying to accomplish in this thinking process right now with my higher power. What is the situation? What are my feelings about it? What are the opportunities? And it's really like a four step that you're doing just on this question or this decision or, you know, resolution of your feelings around it. And, let's just take a couple minutes and let everybody, do a little four step inventory on their. All right, guys, we're going to keep moving on now. Is everybody pretty comfortable with that? I'm seeing some nodding heads. Okay. All right. Okay, so now that we've done an inventory, we have some clarity about the next right thing for us. And so given what you now know, what is the next right action or decision? So I want you to come to that conclusion for yourself, you and God, and it may be that I'm not really done making a decision and that I'm going to need to circle back to this, or there may be some research I still need to do, or it may be that I'm going to take a couple days and pray about it. It may be that I need to talk to, you know, some codependents in recovery whose recovery I respect and get feedback about my choice, you know. And that's okay too. That's your next right thing. But that's that at this stage, that still is a conclusion, and you can feel safe and cared for in that step in the process, instead of feeling like it's this crazy thing you've got to fix or figure out, you know? But that you can have arrived at that point and it's like, okay, now I'm at this point. And so then I take these steps and then I do it this way. And then I listen to my gut and let it unfold. And, you know, and so we don't get lost in that little kid that feels so overwhelmed with such a big thing and all the stories that go with that, that it could go wrong or it could be, I could be, you know, that keep us trapped in the cycle. So, and then G is of course God, and praying for the power to carry it out. So now that I know what my next step is, I've gotten clarity. I can hang on to that. I've just arrived at what I sense in this moment is God's will, you know, and that doesn't mean that it won't change, you know, but right now I'm, you know, in a place where I have an understanding of what I need to do next. And I have asked God for, to be with me through this decision-making process. And I can trust that I can lean into this decision. I can lean into my next right thing around this. And then I'm done. And then I stop. And then I don't let obsession take over, you know, and I don't let it tell me the stories that all of it's going to go south. Or so that's where this can be. It has a beginning and it has an end, and it has a boundary that says, I'm not God. I don't solve the problem. I don't have all the answers. I don't have a crystal ball. You know, I do my part. My part is from here to here. And then God's part is what takes on after that. And that is me being right sized and honoring that decision to turn my will and my life over to God. Here's my part. And everything before that's God's, and everything after that's God's, you know, and I bring God into that too, you know. So for me, this is a process that helps me to have boundaries and guidelines with my obsession so that I know when I'm in healthy thinking and when I'm not. And I can at any point surrender and get back into this process. So I hope that is a helpful tool for you guys. I'm going to read through a little bit of this stuff at the bottom. So, at each step, stop moving forward if the integrity of healthy thinking is lost. So, for example, if you start with, T for time boundary and realize that you don't have enough time to set aside for a healthy thinking process, like if you're going to be in a hurry to think about this because you only got 5 minutes from the car door to your desk, like maybe that'd be better not to put yourself in that crazy situation of trying to figure out something important, you know, while you're saying hi to everybody and getting coffee, you know? And so just like learn to have a boundary with you and set aside and feel safety in the boundary process, you know, because the codependence tells us I have to figure it out right now. And it tells us the obsession is the safety, you know, getting to the answer and having all the answers and being in control of it. That's what gives us a sense of safety. And we have to shift that. Or if you check in with your inner child and there's big feelings there, that might be a sign, that those need your attention more than thinking. It isn't time to make this decision. It's time to settle down your little girl or your little boy, to calm them down, to reassure them, to be there for them, to pull out of that fear, to get back in your adult. It might not be the time to make a decision because your little kid's going to be the one trying to decide. And kids' thinking is not the same as grown-ups' thinking, you know, and fear-based thinking is childish thinking. So we have to get back in our wholeness in order to have a healthy thinking process, and not fear a little kid. So, so anyway, some important things to think about. At any point that you get triggered into shame, one up or one down, or panic, change the focus to caring about you and your feelings instead of the life situation. You and your loving care are always the pathway to the right decisions about your life, you know, and, you know, scrambling and picking and poking and analyzing, you know, that is not the way to get to God's will. It just doesn't work. So, that is really it. There's another part of the handout, I think. There was the last page on the handout is sharing about my obsession making decisions, and I welcome you to explore that or read that and see if any of that, you know, rings the bell or helps you in your own process of understanding where some of your dysfunction might come from and, you know, what's under why we do these crazy things, you know. But that's really not part of the workshop. It's just something that I wanted to share. So I welcome you to read it on your own time. And I think that I still have a little bit of time now to do some Q&A for the next minutes. And then we are done. So I want to just open the floor to anybody wants to share about what their process was with the healthy thinking, or if you have questions.
I have a question. Are you saying there's a sixth page? I don't have a sixth page.
Did I not add that on, Sarah?
Or maybe I don't have the latest. You're muted.
Oh, I?
No, Sarah's muted.
I don't even have I think I only got five.
Really? Okay.
I only received five.
Maybe I'll read it then if we have time.
How does obsession tie into codependence? Has there always been a connection? Or I definitely see the connection. It's just, it doesn't seem like when we read any of the literature, or anything, it doesn't like focus on obsession as mainly a main component. It seems sort of like it's not talked about it that much.
Right. It does refer to it, and I wish I had done a little more homework around tying it to our CODA literature. But you can see a lot of the stuff that I've talked about today is in the patterns and characteristics.
Oh, it is?
Okay. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking about classic avoidance patterns, you know, like obsessing about one thing creates avoidance somewhere else, you know.
Oh, right.
Like I said, kind of
I crave sex. Yeah, like I crave sex instead of wanting love, right?
Right.
That's a good one.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of ways that obsession is, it's sort of the vehicle by which a lot of the patterns and characteristics play out. You know, they don't, like I said in the beginning, they don't really have any other way to play out unless you think about them.
Right.
The harder you think about them, the obsessive thinking about them is what gives them power and allows them to generate the feelings.
So it's like at the core. It's like a
shut down. Yeah, it's really the vehicle. You know, it's really the vehicle for lots of the patterns and characteristics. I guess that's the best way to answer that.
Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Does anybody feel like being brave and talking about what they used the healthy thinking tool for?
Constantine, I'm a codependent. I recently broke up with my ex-partner. I had a relationship of a year, but within 4 months it became a total obsession. And even though I have broken up, I still think of him
Well, I realize it has, what the way I think of him has nothing to do with the reality of my of the present moment or my life at the moment. Yeah. And it, I use it for that. Today I had a little ceremony of letting go, and then I had this workshop today, and I think it's really helpful because I don't know, it's like I have kind of trauma bonding with him. It's the stress of thinking of him creates all the anxiety, and it's a very good excuse for me for losing my focus of my life. I guess I've been doing that since forever, but this is just a very good example. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. My that for sure is my biggest trigger choice in obsession is relationships and relationships, you know, ending and you know what he did wrong or what I should have done instead, or you know, just all the stories and stories and stories, and you know, all of that keeps me tied in. And you know, it's not enough that I made him my higher power in the relationship, but you know, years later he's still my higher power of source. He's just a villainized higher power, but you know, still, like, I'm trying to find my answers by analyzing him, and you know, that doesn't serve anybody, you know. And he doesn't even know about it, and I'm still going over it and going over it and going over it and can't stop, you know? So yeah, super, super powerless. And that's why, you know, just to have, you know, hitting a bottom with it, it's about him. He did not cause this. He did, you know, he did his own harm, but this is harm I'm doing to me. And then owning it and having boundaries and moving forward and asking my higher power to remove it. And, you know, being honest with myself about what it's costing me, which is what you talked about, you know, which is that my present life, you know, years into recovery going, I've worked my ass off to love myself and find my wings in recovery and, you know, create this healthy, safe, loving environment for me. And, you know, it still is tainted by this pattern of mine where I want to go back into all these self-destructive thinking patterns, you know, and an obsession was the reason, you know, shame is really the reason, but again, shame has to have a vehicle and obsession is the vehicle.
I want to add, like, I started taking Prozac recently, and it seems to have helped me with the obsessive compulsive is something that it can treat, like, besides just the depression. I feel like I'm not obsessing quite so much just due to the Prozac, and I'm also, well, I'm working too, but that factor is very helpful in my life right now, so I'm thankful for that.
Thanks, Chris. Marie, did you have something?
Yeah, hi, Marie, codependent. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Just kidding. I'm really grateful to be here today and to be able to tune in and be all the way over here in Phoenix. And, you know, so anyway, I could go on and on. But, you know, I'm really seeing how... Like, I'd been aware for a while that I would resist and try to manage and control and cram down my obsession instead of trying to find healthier ways to deal with it. And it's been harmful and painful. And instead of trying to arrest it, you know, I would get to a certain point where I was resisting it, and then I would just let the floodgates open. And I was like, you know, screw it. I can't stop it. You know, there's no way. It's not possible, whatever. And also, I'm seeing really clearly recently how I go into victimization quite a bit, you know, like, oh God, I work 12-hour shifts. Oh, I work the night shift. Oh, life is so hard, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and just getting to a place of being right-sized with that. And so, you know, those are just things that I'm working on. And, you know, I feel like this workshop will help with that and just, you know, a multitude of other areas where I obsess. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Anyone have questions?
Hey, hi. Lisha. Oh. And I just wanted to comment that I really love the healthy thinking, the thinking acronym, that it really starts out with the time boundary. But when I look at that whole thing, it's all about my higher power. And I think it's interesting how when it comes to other addictions in life, it's very easy, or it's easier for me to reach out to my higher power. But the last thing that I think about during an obsession is that I could get help from my higher power. And that's really the first place that I should go. And I love that whole acronym. I think it's great, and I think it's a great reminder. So thank you, Heidi, and thank you for this workshop.
You're welcome. Thank you. I think what you pointed out is really, you know, that that the last thing that we think about is reaching out to our higher power, and part of that is because we're little, like we're regressed. We're in our little kid, and our little kid didn't learn how to pray. Our little kid isn't the one that instinctively thinks of that. Our little kid isn't the one that has learned how to do that in recovery, you know? You know, I know for me, my little kid, that's not what my little kid wants to do. You know, that's not my little kid's reflex, I guess, to when things are hard. She has to be alone and figure it out for herself. That's how it felt when she was a little kid. That's what my life was like as a child. She wasn't safe to talk to anyone. She wasn't safe to ask for help. That weakness, that was vulnerable, that was stupid. She was going to be shamed for it, you know, so that isn't her instinct, you know. That's my healthy recovery behavior now as an adult. But when I'm repressed, I go right, my brain is trained to go right back to those old patterns and characteristics, which is, you know, isolate, figure it out, keep it a secret, you know, obsess, you know. So I think that's a really good point. And again, that reason why it's important to grow ourselves up before we think, you know. So thanks, Lisha.
Hi, Rebecca Codependent.
Hi.
Hi. Oh. Somebody else? Am I still on?
Yep.
You are, Rebecca. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes. Point of the regressed child. I'm running in my head. That was the biggest aha to me, is that it's just what's causing the obsessive thoughts is that child who wounded, who was unable to act or anything, powerless. And the other thing I really appreciate you sharing was the affirmation of, I get to assign value. I get to take my power back.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the key when those obsessive thoughts are running the show. That's the point at which you can step in with your inner parent and really just heal the situation. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Barbara. Yeah.
Thanks.
It's my job to make a safe world for me to live in. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Sarah, codependent.
I
want to thank Heidi very much. And I think we should close the workshop. I don't know if anybody wants to stick around after and talk more. And we're going to give Heidi's contact information. So do you want to do that now, Heidi?
Sure. Yeah. Do you want me to just put it on the chat, or what would be easiest?
probably for people that don't see that, you could read it too. Or I mean,
okay.
And I will. I'll go ahead and pause the recording while you're setting your phone numbers.
A lot of those seminars, and I hear at meetings. That's the way it's being at students. When I've done here in California, I've done secretary and just like different jobs, different meetings, and that. And we have a seminar in October every year for the last 4 years. We'll have our fifth one this year. And
what are we hearing?
I love being able to spread the word because, you know, it's
what are we hearing?
Not overwhelming, and I don't.
I'm trying to find out where it's coming from.
I'm just glad to be able to do that because I've gotten so much from the program. I'm also on the camp committee. We have retreats here twice a year.
Next
week is supposed to be our retreat up in the mountains, so it got canceled.
Oh, well, okay. Thank you.
Thanks, yeah. Okay, well, it's 4:30. If anybody wants to stay after, and I'll read that last page, it's not a super big deal. It was just a journaling, sharing thing that I did, and it felt appropriate for this topic. So if anybody wants to stay afterwards, we can talk about that, and I could, you know, ask if people have questions or whatever, but we'll wrap up so that way we can all close together and people can move on with their day if they want to. How's that sound, Sarah?
Okay, sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you. I've asked Christian to read the promises. Chris?
Yeah, I just got to make sure I'm unmuted. The 12 promises of Codependence Anonymous. I can expect a miraculous change in my life by working the program 12 of Codependence Anonymous. As I make an honest effort to work the 12 steps and follow the 12 traditions, 1, I know a new sense of belonging. The feeling of emptiness and loneliness will disappear. 2, I am no longer controlled by my fears. I overcome my fears and act with courage, integrity, and dignity. 3, I know a new freedom. 4, I release myself from worry, guilt, and regret about my past and present. I am aware enough not to repeat it. 5, I know a new love and acceptance of myself and others. I feel genuinely lovable, loving, and loved. 6, I learn to see myself as equal to others. My new and renewed relationships are with equal partners. 7, I am capable of developing and maintaining healthy and loving relationships. The need to control and manipulate others will disappear as I trust those who are trustworthy. 8, I learned that it is possible to mend, to become more loving, intimate, and supportive. I have the choice of communicating with my family in a way which is safer for me and respectful for them. 9, I acknowledge that I am a unique and precious creation. 10, I no longer need to rely solely on others to provide my sense of self-worth. 11, I trust the guidance I've received from my higher power and come to believe in my own capabilities. And 12, I gradually experience serenity, strength, and spiritual growth in my daily life.
Thanks, Chris. Let us close with the Coda closing prayer, followed by the serenity prayer. And again, if you could remain on mute and follow along with me.
Weird.
Otherwise, it sounds like gobbledygook. Coda closing prayer. We thank our higher power for all we have received from this meeting. As we close, may we take with us the wisdom, love, acceptance, and hope of recovery. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back. It works if you work it because you're worth it, and you've got to work it every day. Thanks, y'all.